This morning, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Eric Lloyd, who's an orthopedic surgeon with our orthopedic group here, Boca Raton Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Dr. Lloyd did his undergraduate work at University of California, Berkeley, and then went to medical school at Columbia University in New York, subsequently did an orthopedic surgery residency at Jackson Memorial, and then a fellowship in foot and ankle surgery at Hospital for Special Surgery. Today he's going to give us a talk on treatment of common foot and ankle injuries, which is something we do see a lot in internal medicine. My pleasure.
All right. So I'm Dr. Eric Lloyd, one of the orthopedic surgeons here at Boca Regional. Today we'll talk about treatment of common foot and ankle injuries. Thank you, Dr. Rubin, for the introduction. I have no disclosures. Currently, I've been in practice here about 4 years. I work with Dr. Bergman, Dr. Saperstein, and Dr. Young. I practice general orthopedics. I do hip fractures, upper and lower extremity trauma, sports, arthritis, deformity correction, and the main focus that I enjoy secondary to my fellowship training is treatment of foot and ankle conditions. I grew up in Southern California, went to University of California, Berkeley. I graduated in 2001, went to medical school at Columbia University, did my residency and internship at University of Miami, Jackson Memorial, and completed my foot and ankle fellowship at Hospital for Special Surgery in 2013. So orthopedic surgery is the treatment of injuries and diseases of the musculoskeletal system. Involves everything from bones, joints, ligaments, tendons, muscles, and nerves. So today we're going to focus more on acute orthopedic injuries. So examples are injuries to the bone would involve a fracture, injuries to the ligaments, sprains, injuries to the muscles, strains, and injuries to the tendons such as a tear or a rupture. So on the bottom we can see, an Achilles rupture, and on the top we can see a break in the cortical bones, and that's an ankle fracture. So we'll review some common foot and ankle injuries and some not so common foot and ankle injuries. We'll review anatomy, physical examination, and special tests that you can obtain or perform. We'll compare conservative and surgical treatments, and we'll do this through case presentations. So the objectives that are listed are at the end of the talk, you'd like to be able to name 3 commonly missed foot and ankle injuries. You want to discuss the pros and cons of operative and non-operative treatment for Achilles ruptures and discuss treatment options for ankle fractures. So if we follow a standardized approach towards all orthopedic injuries, it becomes fairly easy. We want to make sure that we obtain a detailed history. We want to know what happened, when it happened, how it's affecting them now. What the problem that brings them to you is. We want to make sure that we do a detailed physical examination. Many times people will say, I have pain in my foot or in my ankle, and that we need to know a lot more than just that, so that's where the physical exam comes into play. We then order the appropriate imaging studies, and that will all of those will then bring us to a diagnosis and then allow us to present treatment options and initiate treatment. So with our history, we want to know the details of what happened. We want to know the details of the trauma, what type of trauma it was. Was it a crush injury? Was it a sporting injury? Were they just standing up? We want to know the position of the foot at the time of injury. We want to know the mechanism. We want to know if the patient was able to ambulate after the injury. And we want to know if they heard a sound or there was anything else at the time of injury. As I said, people tend to generalize and say it's my leg, my ankle, my foot hurts. And even when you ask them to point with one finger, they end up pointing with their whole hand. And so really try to get them to pinpoint on one area so you can localize where the problem really is. We want to know if we want to ask them if the pain radiates anywhere. We want to know the quality of the pain. Is it sharp, dull? Is there an ache associated with it? We want to know the severity on a scale of 1 to 10. We want to know what the aggravating and alleviating factors are. Does weight bearing make Does the weight bearing make the pain worse? So we do this through our just standard steps of a physical examination. We want to look, feel, and move. So my examination starts by just watching the patient walk from x-ray to the room, or watching them walk in to the office, because that's going to tell you a lot. If they're able to weight bear, if they're limping, if there's anything going on, if they're favoring one side, excuse me. And so after that, after you then see them and obtain a history, then you want to examine just by looking. You want to check the swelling, deformity, any skin conditions, any cuts, anything that is something that you would observe. And then you can move on to the feeling part of it. That's where you put your hands actually on the foot and ankle. I tend to wait on the localized tenderness. I try to check everything else first. I want to make sure that their foot's warm, their foot's well perfused, check to see where the areas of swelling are before going and finding the area of tenderness. Check every other part before you check the point where you think the problem is, because as soon as you touch that spot, they're going to jump and they're going to avoid letting you examine them anymore. So I tend to leave that a little bit till later, and then I ask them to move their foot up and down, move it in a circle, check to see for any deficiencies, and then you can check where they're painful by palpation and check the different areas to figure out where the painful spot is. And because there's usually, for the most part, two, always compare it to the other side. Don't just have them take off the one sock and shoe. Always have the other side to evaluate, because there are variations on normal, and it's important to be able to see what their baseline is. So just to review the physical exam, when you inspect it, you want to note swelling, you want to note ecchymoses, you want to note deformity, you want to know if there's any edema, range of motion. For the ankle, we look at dorsiflexion and plantar flexion, usually about 20 degrees dorsiflexion to 40 degrees plantar flexion. And we also want to see inversion and eversion. We look for any evidence of a deformity. We test the strength. And we make sure we palpate all the important structures from the medial malleolus, lateral malleolus, base of the fifth metatarsal, the Achilles, the midfoot, and also the proximal fibula, we'll show later. You also want to make sure you assess neurovascular status. So after you've obtained the history and done the physical exam, you want to know when to obtain x-rays. So we don't want to just x-ray every single person that has a foot or ankle injury. The Ottawa ankle rules have helped to decrease the amount of radiographs that are ordered. So basically with these, this helps guide us if we're doing ankle x-rays or foot x-rays. And for example, in the ER, or in the office, if someone's unable to weight bear immediately after the injury, or in the emergency department, or in your office for more than four steps, then that mandates that you should that you must obtain x-rays. So for the ankle, you would obtain an ankle x-ray if this is on the medial side, so the inside part of the ankle. If you are tender on the posterior aspect or the tip of the medial mal, or if you are tender on the posterior edge of the lateral malleolus or the tip of the lateral malleolus, or you have that inability to bear weight, then you would get a ankle x-ray. The reason it's on the posterior is that more localizes the bone. If it's on the anterior, as we'll see later, that's more where the ligamentous attachments tend to be injured, and that's where the tenderness is with them. Regarding the foot x-rays, same idea, inability to ambulate, and tenderness at the navicular or tenderness at the base of the fifth metatarsal. The other big part is that even if your initial x-rays are negative, if a patient continues to have pain, you want to make sure that you obtain x-rays down the road. So if it's been 1 week, 2 weeks, and they're still limping, they're still having problems, even if that initial set of x-rays are negative, you want to make sure you repeat x-rays, because sometimes the fracture will displace slightly or start to resorb, and then you'll be able to see the fracture on a later x-ray. These rules don't apply if you're under 18, if you're pregnant, if you have multiple painful conditions, such as you were in a motorcycle crash and you broke your tibia. then you're not going to be focused quite as much on your other ankle if you just have a small base of the fifth metatarsal and the other side's an open tibia. So the other thing is if you have compromised sensation, neuropathy, diabetes, et cetera. So with our standard radiographs, there are three views for the ankle that we obtain, an AP, a mortise, and a lateral. It's ideal that these be weight-bearing so that we can evaluate if there is any structural loss of integrity. What we're looking for is any sort of fracture, dislocation, or abnormal widening. So in here we can see this is the tibio-talar joint. You can see here's the tibia, here's the fibula, talus. And what we're looking at is we want to make sure that this here, Shenton's line, is intact and that there's no evidence of any articular step off. We can also look at the cortices here and make sure that those are in line and that there's no evidence of a cortical breach that would indicate a fracture. Everything seems to be well in line, and that's a normal AP. We move to a lateral and a mortise view. We can see that the fibula and the tibia overlap here, and this is the outline of the fibula on the lateral view. You can see that the talar head is centered in the distal tibial plafond, and that's how a standard ankle radiograph should look. We have the calcaneus, the talus, navicular, cuboid, and sometimes you can also see the base of the fifth on the lateral ankle x-ray. And then the mortise view just is a bit of internal rotation of the ankle, and that gives us a nice view of our talus and to ensure that there's no lateral shift of our talus, which again I'll show you guys later. So in addition to x-rays, we can always order additional diagnostic studies. As I said, we can do serial x-rays. We can do a CT scan, which is excellent at looking at the amount of displacement of the bone. And we can do an MRI, which can help find occult fractures, soft tissue injuries, and is an excellent sensitive test that we utilize often. So when we combine all this together, it helps us to come up with a diagnosis, which then will allow us to formulate a treatment plan. So here we can see on this x-ray, this is an oblique view of the foot. We can see that here's a cortice, and there's a breach in the cortice right there. So that black line represents a fracture at the base of the fifth metatarsal. and with this particular fracture, we could treat that conservatively, or we could treat it with a screw if need be. This all depends on the patient and their demands and their medical comorbidities. So with this x-ray here, we can see that this looks to be like a mortise view. And we can see that the fibula should be straight up and down and it should be intact, but we can see that there's a fracture here and there's a fracture over here on the medial mal. So the talus has shifted over, and that's not in the great position there because this is your nice articular surface and this is rubbing up on this nice sharp piece of bone, and that's going to hurt. So other studies that we can do MRIs. And MRIs, as I said, are good for soft tissue injuries. So here we can see a normal Achilles tendon, and here we can see that it's a torn Achilles tendon. So we can see fluid, and it's great at helping us to make further diagnoses. Here's an example of a higher energy ankle trauma, and we can see that the impact has led to a significant distal tibia fracture. This is called a pilon fracture. And on our physical exam, we can see that there's deformity. This is not the pilon, but this is just an example of a dislocation. So we can see that the ankle is not set in the appropriate position, and therefore you would call ortho and we'll pull on it, or you could pull on it yourself. The other important thing is that we want to be able to make accurate diagnoses by doing more of a functional exam. So here we can see that the distal fibula is here. This is a lateral view of the ankle. And we can see that our tendon is crossing right here. This should be passing behind the lateral mal, but it's now subluxed and come out in front of where it should be. So it's lost its structural integrity. And sometimes imaging studies do not show us that, And if you just examine the patient without them standing or doing a functional maneuver, you may miss that. So in orthopedics, generally, we have conservative versus operative treatment of all conditions. We base the treatment on various factors, including age, activity level prior to injury, athlete, medical comorbidities. If a person doesn't walk, doesn't do anything, is diabetic, has an ejection fraction of 10%, and you know they break their fifth metatarsal, we're probably not going to offer them surgical treatment just because all it's going to do is probably create a problem for them. They're at a very high risk. So we need to take all that into account. So specifically for fractures, the different treatment options that we consider are closed reduction of the fracture with a temporary splinting, and we can see that if the fracture is displaced here, we reduce it and then put it in a form of stabilization. We can do an open reduction internal fixation where we actually make an incision, go down to the bone, put it in the right spot, and then we fix it with plate and screws or other constructs. We can perform intramedullary fixation, which involves stabilization by placement of a rod in the intramedullary portion of the bone. And sometimes in cases with swelling or other medical comorbidities, this is a less invasive procedure, which is an external fixator and holds it in position. And sometimes this is a temporary fixation, so we can go back later and perform definitive fixation. So now we'll go through some case studies, just discuss the differential diagnosis, specific injuries, anatomy, special tests, findings, and treatment. We're probably going to discuss about four or five different cases. So for case one, 35-year-old woman sustained an ankle inversion injury while playing soccer. She's able to weight bear after the injury. The pain's localized to the lateral ankle. On exam, she's got no bony tenderness. She's got significant swelling of the lateral ankle. And she's got good endpoint on anterior drawer and Taylor tilt tests. she's neurovascularly intact. So what are the clues for the for our differential diagnosis? So the things that we wanted to catch from the history and the physical exam, one is that it's an inversion injury. Two is that she has a tenderness and swelling at the anterior lateral ankle without tenderness at the bony prominences. She's able to weight bear, and she has good endpoint on anterior drawer. So our diagnosis is an ankle sprain, likely an ATFL injury. And ankle sprains are fairly common. About 1 million people present to physicians with acute ankle injuries each year. They're about 25% of all sports-related injuries. About 50% of that soccer and basketball-related. And the lateral ankle ligaments are the most commonly injured structures in young athletes, 10 times more than the medial side. And there's potential for these sprains to develop into chronic problems, such as instability of the ankle and chronic pain. So in looking at the anatomy of our lateral ankle, we can see that the ligaments provide stability and stabilize the talus underneath the tibio, underneath the distal tibia and fibula. The one that is usually sprained is first is the anterior talofibular. That's an ATFL, and that's usually injured in a plantar flexed ankle. You can see that anterior talofibular ligament right here. If this is pointed downward, this is going to be more stretched and more apt to tear. The calcaneofibular ligament, the CFL, goes from the fibula to the calcaneus here. That's one of the strongest ligaments there, and that would be injured in a dorsiflexed ankle because if the foot is going up, you can see this is going to be on a bit more tension, and then if the foot inverts, that will tear. you also have a couple other ligaments here, but not quite as important as those two, posterior talofibular and anterior tibiofibular ligament. when you have an ankle sprain, your injuries will be classified into three different grades. You can have a grade 1, 2, or 3. Grade 1 is a partial tear, so normal ligament. Grade 1 partial tear, you get little defects in the ligament, which can lead to the small defects from stretching and cause little tearing, but you don't have any loss of integrity of the ankle stability. Grade 2 is a partial tear, grade 2 sprain, partial tear, and basically that has some degree of structural instability, but overall the ligament is still intact. Grade 3, complete disruption with loss of structural integrity. So with a lateral ankle sprain, our physical exam, it's the lateral aspect of the ankle, we're going to see soft tissue swelling, plus or minus ecchymoses, anterior and inferior to the malleolus. So it's going to be, here's our malleolus right here. It's going to be a little bit more anterior and a little more distal. This is where all the swelling occurs. We want to differentiate that from supramalleolar swelling and tenderness, which may indicate a fracture or an injury in the syndesmotic area of the ankle. Our special exam or physical exam tests are the anterior drawer and the Taylor tilt. Anterior drawer specifically tests the integrity of the ATFL, and it's performed with the knee at 90 degrees and the foot slightly plantar flexed, and you stabilize the distal tibia, and you perform a shucking maneuver or pulling the foot and forward on the tibia. You evaluate the amount of anterior translation of the talus, and again, always compare it to the contralateral side because some people naturally have a good amount of give. The normal is anywhere from 2 millimeters to 9 millimeters. And then you want to test Taylor tilt to test the integrity of your CFL. And that's basically with stabilizing the distal tibia, keeping the foot or the ankle in a neutral position, and inverting the foot. So a positive Taylor tilt test usually indicates a significant sprain, a grade 3 sprain, because of the strength of this ligament. So with simple ankle sprains, imaging is usually not necessary unless there's something on the Ottawa ankle rules that states you need to get it. If there was medial ankle pain, medial ankle ecchymoses, then we get concerned that there may be something else going on, and then you definitely should get x-rays and even possibly an MRI. MRIs for an acute ankle sprain are not necessary because most of our treatment will revolve around the non-operative management. Our treatment of ankle sprains involves a standard RICE protocol with a short period of protection in the beginning. We use either a splint, a walking boot, and crutches. Usually what we do is a walking boot. I discourage use of crutches for grade 1 and grade 2 sprains. I want people to be walking on this. I want them to get back to their activity level. It's important that they rest. It's important that they ice, compress, and elevate. Really, the key here is elevation to help reduce swelling. And then we begin on a treatment, a plan for functional rehab. So weight bearing as soon as tolerated, passive and active range of motion, and we progress to resistance exercises and proprioceptive exercises. Returning to activities, grade 1 sprain, 3 to 5 days, grade 2, 1 to 3 weeks, and grade 3 can be up to 2 to 3 months to get back to your prior level of activity. And I tend to recommend ankle protection for about 6 months after a severe sprain. So when do you involve an orthopedist? The majority of grade 1 sprains tend to be treated by a primary or a trainer on the field in sporting injuries. And an orthopedist doesn't necessarily have to be involved. As you can see, people tend to get back to action and within a week with a grade 1 sprain. So by the time they got everything figured out and actually made it in, they'd probably be feeling better. However, we should be involved if there is any evidence of severe laxity, if the patient's reporting significant instability. Obviously, if there's a fracture, you can call us. and if there's any ecchymoses on the medial side. Again, if this is purely a lateral ankle injury, then there shouldn't be anything going on the inside part of the ankle. Usually, about 80-90% of this is treatment is successful. However, sometimes it is unsuccessful, and then if it is and orthopedist has not been involved, then we should be. So do we need surgery for acute ankle sprains? The majority of patients respond to non-operative management and physical therapy, physical therapy, physical therapy. Most people are not consistent with it, and if they're not, then we just have to really encourage that. Surgery is recommended when there's persistent pain or instability. And this can occur with the chronic ligament injuries. So if you have chronic ankle instability, such as the ligament ruptured or has a tear and it did not heal in the right position, and they're unable to overcome their functional deficits through physical therapy where the muscles can stabilize the ankle, then they may be a candidate for surgical repair. Surgical repair would be a direct repair with augmentation of the lateral ligamentous structures. So you can see here's the tear, repair, and then augmentation with the retinaculum. It's called the Broström procedure. There's just a pictures for it, lateral ankle, incision, going through and prepping the site where the ATFL originates, repair with a suture anchor, and then completing the Broström procedure. So that's your standard ankle sprain. Move on to case two. Case two, a 23-year-old man was playing rugby yesterday, pulled backwards by another player, right foot was planted. He's been able to bear weight since the injury, but with pain, mild ankle swelling, pain with weight bearing. His anterior drawer is normal, and Taylor tilt is normal. Positive squeeze test and neurovascularly intact. So these are his x-rays. Does anyone see anything wrong with the x-rays? Huh? Well, we're missing a lateral is one thing, but the other thing is just that these are non-weight-bearing x-rays. So these x-rays look good. I don't see anything wrong with them. They actually look fine. Just, you know, they're not putting weight on it. So what other studies may help our diagnosis? So the guy has ankle pain. He's having pain with weight-bearing. Can't really put weight down on it. So we decide to get a stress view. So when stress view can be obtained either by standing, getting a weight-bearing x-ray, or by physically taking the foot and pulling it. And we can see that when we do that, the talus slides over and this space opens up. So this should all be even there and there, and it's not. So the diagnosis is a syndesmotic injury or what's called a high ankle sprain. And we can see that our syndesmotic ligaments are torn here, and that allows for lateral translation. Syndesmotic injury is less common, more easily misdiagnosed. It's referred to as a high ankle sprain. It's above the ankle joint. And this is more common in collision sports, though a less common injury represents maybe 1 to 10% of ankle sprains. Our anatomy of the syndesmosis, the idea is that if this is our fibula, the syndesmosis helps prevent lateral translation of the talus and of the fibula, and 90% of this is obtained through three major ligaments: the anterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, the AITFL, the posterior inferior tibiofibular ligament, the PITFL, and the interosseous membrane. So our special, with a physical examination, you're going to have pain with an external rotation, positive squeeze test, and swelling and tenderness usually proximal to the lateral malleolus that's above the ankle joint. So to further elaborate on the special tests, the squeeze test performed by squeezing the fibula and the tibia at mid-calf, and this would be an abnormal test or a positive test if you had pain in the ankle region at the syndesmosis. An external rotation test performed with externally rotating the foot with the knee held at 90 degrees of flexion. And this would be abnormal if pain is elicited at the distal syndesmosis, basically the anterior lateral ankle joint. So as I said, weight-bearing x-rays are fairly key in diagnosing this. our treatment of syndesmotic injuries. Type 1 injury is a normal x-ray. There's no diastasis or gapping that occurs down here. And if that's the case, it's a simple sprain, type grade 1, type 1 injury. And we can begin a period of booting and functional rehab protocol that's similar for simple sprains. And type 2 injury, you have this space here, the fib clear space, and that'll increase. If that's more than 6 millimeters, then we have to consider that there's a lack of stability at the syndesmosis, and therefore it would either benefit from surgical reduction and fixation, or you could treat it non-operatively. Again, this is going to depend on your history and what the patient's comorbidities are and what their activity level is. And what we would do is do a non-weight-bearing cast for about 1 month, and then a boot for 4 weeks, and progress weight-bearing after about 4 to 6 weeks if stable. Type 3 injury shows just frank diastasis, and that means that it's just completely unstable. In those injuries, we do recommend fixation. It's important to realize that these high ankle sprains, when we hear about it in the news or wherever athletes have it, these always take much longer to recover. So, you know, compared to those numbers I gave you for a lateral ankle sprain of 1 to 3 days, 2 to 3 weeks, these are taking 8 to 12 weeks for just a type 1 and type 2 to get better. Specifically for how do we stabilize the syndesmosis, there's lots of different ways to do this, but we can use screws, or we can use something called a tightrope, which allows for a little bit more give. If you think the distal tib-fib joint at the syndesmosis has normal amount of motion at it, so it does rotate, it does shift back and forth when we ambulate. If you put screws across it, you're asking it to be completely still. And so the idea is that they've come up with different ideas to hold the fibula over and prevent lateral translation, but also still allow for that rotation and motion. When we do the fixation, we reduce the syndesmosis in the appropriate position, and we place the fixation construct roughly 1.5 centimeters proximal to the plafond. And the plafond is the distal tibial articular surface. So why is it important to examine the knee of a person that had an ankle injury? Anyone? What's that? Correct. They could injure both. And then also there's a lot of times that one injury in particular is missed. And this is called a Maisonneuve fracture. And if you just look at the x-ray of the ankle, you may see there's like a little chip on the, a little avulsion chip of the medial mal. But, you know, overall, this doesn't look too bad. It's probably non-weight-bearing. You're not seeing, it's definitely non-weight-bearing because you're not seeing really this increase in the clear space there. It looks okay, and you may send the patient out and say, hey, you know, you just have a chip avulsion off your medial mal. You know, it's kind of like an ankle sprain. You'll be fine. Just walk it off. And, you know, they walk around, and because they're so focused on the ankle, you forget about the knee, or you forget about the other areas of pain, or they may have a vague sense of discomfort up on the leg and kind of just defer. It's, you know, hey, it's just you injured your ankle, you fell on your leg, you know, it's what happens. And so whenever you examine the leg, I just always have one hand up near the knee, you know, and like if there is any question of this, you can palpate the knee and then obtain a knee x-ray or a tib-fib x-ray in addition to your ankle. And this is important because this is operative and you want to stabilize it because you have broken through or torn through this strong, sturdy ligament and come through your entire syndesmosis and traveled all the way up to here and exited out the bone there. So it's a completely unstable injury, and if you have someone just go walk around on it, they're not going to be happy. So case 3, 27-year-old male lacrosse player, injured ankle, injured his right foot, caught in a divot, seen at a facility, obtained a normal ankle x-ray, discharged with walking boot crutches, started noticing a significant swelling and ecchymoses on the midfoot, tenderness over the TMT, tarsometatarsal joints, and significant pain with weight bearing. So what's our next step? So next step is we want to get imaging of the foot. So following the Ottawa guidelines, he's got pain in the foot. We want to make sure we get the foot too. Anyone notice anything different on the foot x-ray? This is nice. It's bilateral. It's the left foot. It's the right foot. He injured the right foot. Does anything look different? What was that? The swelling? There's probably going to be a lot of swelling there as well. But if we look here and compare it to there, so we can see here there's not too much of a space. And on this side, we can see more darkness. So that means that there's more of a gap there. So there's some form of instability there on the foot. So what's abnormal? Basically, this is a Lisfranc injury, and it's very commonly missed, and it's extremely important to be able to diagnose or to see. If you obtain a non-weight-bearing x-ray there, you may not see that. And that's where the weight-bearing x-ray comes into play, because then you'll be able to see this diastasis. So Lisfranc was a surgeon and gynecologist for Napoleon. And he was the one that really kind of described this injury and described amputations through this area back in the day. This injury led to progressive deformity, progressive problems, and a significant dysfunction. And instead of trying to fix it, they said you get an amputation. So Lisfranc's joint articulation between multiple midfoot bones, you can see that. This is the first metatarsal, second, third, fourth, fifth, and we can see that all these guys have ligamentous attachments, giving them more support. But the second one is more of a Roman arch configuration and has a keystone in this arch, so it lacks the stability that the other ones have. The Lisfranc ligament. It's actually the foot pointed down on this picture. We can see Lisfranc ligament attached from the base of the second metatarsal to the medial cuneiform, and an injury will cause a separation directly in this region. So why is this area prone to injury? As I said, strong connections through the rest of the foot. However, there's no transverse ligament between the first and second metatarsal bases, secondary to that keystone Roman arch configuration. Less support, increased risk of injury. So incidents, not as common of an injury, but the important thing is that 20% of these tend to be overlooked. Lots of people have missed Lisfranc injuries. They're diagnosed as a foot sprain. Whenever I hear foot sprain, it sets off alarms in my head, because it's not as common to have a foot sprain. It's just there's probably something else going on, especially if you've had a foot sprain that's not getting better. In polytrauma patients, it can also be overlooked. There's a lot of other injuries that can occur with it. Our mechanisms of injury can be anything. It can be a trauma, it can be a direct crush, it can be a sports-related injury. So with a direct injury, you have a direct force over the Lisfranc region, and you can have an injury there. You can have this with a sporting injury. It's a typical collision injury with athletics, or crush injury with athletics. We can see with a plantar flexed foot. And twisting injuries can lead to forceful abduction of the forefoot and lead to an injury. Our physical exam findings, you're going to have pain with weight bearing, you're going to have swelling across the dorsum of the foot, and a deformity which may or may not be correctable. The big thing with Lisfranc is you don't want to miss compartment syndrome. So with Lisfranc injuries, the reports are up to 30%. Of people with a significant Lisfranc injury will have compartment syndrome. And with that, about 6% of motorcycle injuries will have some damage to this area. So our standards with compartment syndrome, to remember, are the five P's: pain, which is out of proportion to what you would expect, pallor, so pale skin tone, paresthesias, numbness, pulselessness, a faint pulse, and paralysis. So specifically with Lisfranc, our standing views. On this x-ray, we can see this is a non-weight-bearing view right here, and this is our Lisfranc region from the medial cuneiform to the second base of the second metatarsal. Non-weight bearing looks fine. So we're looking at this lining up right here. It lines up. As soon as they weight bear, we can see that there's a gap and that there's some degree of incongruity there. So this is a stress test. Sometimes people can't do it. They can't weight bear on it. And all your imaging, you can't figure it out. So then you have to go to the OR to do a stress test under anesthesia. And also, there is normal anatomic variant as well, which is important to get the other side. I like having a person get weight-bearing x-rays at bilateral feet. And as I said, if there's suspicion, stress views, MRI, CT scan, bone scan, et cetera. Something called the flex sign. It's tough to see on here, but there's a little piece of bone in there. And what that is that the plantar Lisfranc ligament that attaches the base of the second metatarsal to the medial cuneiform will avulse off. And that avulsion is lateral to the medial cuneiform and medial to the second metatarsal base. It's coined by Meyerson. The key to treatment is early recognition to prevent long-term disability. So if there's a degree of instability but it's reduced and you don't weight bear on it, it has a chance of healing. And if it's misdiagnosed or not seen or recognized and someone goes and walks on it, then it's not going to heal in the right position. Anatomic reduction is necessary for good results, and we want to obtain and maintain that. So if there's no diastasis, if there's no gapping there, we can be non-weight-bearing for about 4 to 6 weeks. Then weight-bearing is tolerated for another 4 to 6 weeks, total treatment 2 to 3 months, and then afterwards protection with an orthotic. Operative treatment for any unstable injury. And our goal is to reduce and stabilize the Lisfranc joints. So example of the hardware that we utilize, we have an incision overlying the medial TMT joints. We can see that here, this is being a right foot. There's a big toe here, little toes. First metatarsal corresponds to here. This right here, medial cuneiform. Here, second metatarsal right here, which is right where Lisfranc ligament is. We can see that this is unreduced. That needs to be right up against there. And so here, it's reduced. Once we get it reduced, we then we hold that in position with hardware. One of the common complications and areas of controversy is do we ORIF it, which is do we just put screws across it? Do we bridge plate it? We put hardware above it and don't put screws through it. Or do we just go right to fusion? Because almost every person with a Lisfranc injury goes on to have some form of post-traumatic arthritis. Not everyone has pain, but people tend to get post-traumatic arthritis just secondary to the severity of the injury. So the treatment, if you do get that and it's painful, you go on to fuse this whole TMT complex here. And there is literature and debate now, should we just do that to start and forget about everything else? Because why are we just trying to salvage these joints? They're going to be arthritic anyways. We're going to get patients keep coming back and difficult diagnoses, and let's just fuse them to start. They're happy with it. And there's different different ways of thought, but that's outside the topic of us today. So return to play. Basically, this is a significant injury. It's very important to temper everyone's expectations. Just understand this can be a long healing process, 4 to 6 months at least, to get back to play or to do your normal activities. And after, even when you get back to play, you want a good supportive, stiff-soled shoe. Case four. So 45-year-old man playing tennis, heard a loud pop, felt like someone kicked him behind his leg, pain with weight-bearing, soft tissue swelling, ecchymoses in the posterior ankle. I'll try to go a bit quicker, though, so just because I know we got, I don't know how much time we have. But basically, our differential diagnosis, we can see left leg, right leg. So we can see ecchymoses. We can see a lot of swelling back here in the posterior ankle. You lose the contour of the bones back here. You have loss of normal resting tone and posture of the foot. So our diagnosis here is an Achilles rupture. Basically, it is fairly common, not as common as ankle fractures or arthritis in the knee. And the big thing is that this affects adults during their productive years, during their 30s, 40s, 50s. And so it's a huge hit to the economic system. The profile tends to be males more than females. The studies say anywhere from a 1.7 to 1 ratio all the way up to a 12 to 1 ratio. Tend to be men in their 30s to 40s, can be an elite athlete, or it could be anyone that's a weekend warrior, goes out, works all week, and then goes out and plays tennis or runs on the weekend. The Achilles is a common is the common tendon of the gastrocnemius and soleus, provides attachment to the calcaneus. An area 2 to 6 centimeters proximal to the insertion on the calcaneus in this region is a somewhat more of an avascular portion. So because of this, you're at increased risk for pathology. Micro tears will then have additive effects and then lead to a rupture. We also have metabolic risk factors if someone's taking local or PO steroids, if someone injected the tendon, or if you're taking fluoroquinolones, which is in the news everywhere, or if you have an inflammatory arthritis. So as you can see, you know, it's if you're prescribing Cipro or Levaquin, these drugs have increased risk of Achilles ruptures. Even healthy tendons rupture, sudden eccentric loading of an asymmetrically stretched tendon can lead to it. Some of the mechanisms, 4-foot push-off with knee extended, such as a sprinter, sudden unexpected dorsiflexion, such as your foot goes into a hole or you step up a curb, didn't see it. It's more common around here, the curbs people trip on. Violent dorsiflexion, a fall from a height. Patients tend to say, I felt a pop or a snap, felt like someone kicked me, couldn't put any weight on it. The important questions for you to ask are, hey, were there any symptoms before this? And did you take any medication recently? Patients still have plantar flexion strength secondary to the accessory muscles, your other flexors, and 25% of these are missed by your initial provider evaluating it. And this is not a good one to miss either. So we can see that when we do a Thompson test, which is patients prone and their legs are up, we have decreased resting tension. So here you can see a bit better. So when we squeeze here, the foot points downward. Here, there's a loss of continuity in it. And there's a palpable defect as well on physical exam. MRI could be used if there's a question. It's not necessary for the diagnosis, and the studies show all it does is delays treatment. Once you get an MRI, the average time to actually get it in the study is about 7 to 10 days, and that just delays your treatment. The management of Achilles, we want to restore the length, tension, and optimize its function, surgery or no surgery. Conservative management typically has been about 10 to 30% re-rupture and a decreased strength. And for that reason, we tend to recommend operative treatment for the younger person or the person that walks and does has an active lifestyle. With surgery, the risk of re-rupture is more about 2%. So you compare 2% to 10 to 30%. However, with operative management, you have a risk of skin infections, 5%, and deep infections, 1%. A deep infection is disastrous. It is a very, very bad complication to get from this, and it can dramatically change the life of a person. So the pendulum's gone back and forth, conservative to surgical treatment. In the 20s, good results with surgery, so everyone did surgery. Then in the 70s, they said, hey, things are good. We don't need surgery anymore. Lancet said it's doubtful whether operative repair can even be justified. And now there's just current debate in, hey, non-op, operative. There's a new functional rehab protocol, which really says you can treat people non-operatively, and as long as you progress them quickly, you can avoid surgery and have the exact same results and decrease your risk of re-rupture. Then, you know, though this is a meta-analysis in 2015, and it recommends surgical fixation and may allow for earlier return to work. The basics of conservative management, splint and plantar flexion, slowly progress back up, do gentle range of motion to encourage a better tendon healing. Surgical management, incision, go down, fix it, straightforward, very easy. Patient factors, so we want to take into account how elderly is the patient, how active are they, what are their comorbidities. Understand they're going to be, no matter what, with surgery or without, they're going to be in a boot for about 2 months. So why obtain a lateral view? I always get a lateral view if I suspect anything. On this x-ray specifically, we can see this little fleck right here. This is a patient I saw last week, actually. And he was actually, this x-ray is read as normal by the radiologist, too. But, you know, you look at it and I can see that. I see the swelling. So because, you know, he doesn't have the advantage of being able to see the patient, I can see the patient and kind of correlate. You could see that this is an actual avulsion from the bottom, or from the insertion, sorry, of the Achilles. You can see it can be either small pieces or big pieces. Okay, and that's real important because that can, this really does mandate surgical treatment unless the patient's really, really sick. That's not going to heal like your standard Achilles rupture. And we want to be aware of this large fragment right here that can masquerade as an Achilles rupture or just a calc fracture. Could be splinted and sent home. We don't want that because this is the patient, that same patient that I treated here about 10 hours after that happened, labeled as a calc fracture. But we can see the skin is compromised here. If she goes out for 5 days, comes to the office in 5 days, she's going to lose all this, and she may lose her foot. So took her to the OR that night, fixed her, got her good. This is the last case, 93-year-old. This is also a case from here. Just wanted to show it just to kind of discuss different treatment options for ankle fractures, our standard booting or fixation. She trips over a curb, has this injury. So we can see that the skin is obviously not intact. She has an open injury. These are her x-rays. She's a minimal ambulator. Because this is a large open injury, it mandates that she's going to the OR. So, you know, if she was just 93 and this was a closed injury, you might be able to just get away with a boot, a cast, and just say, hey, you know, you're 93. We're going to let it heal where it heals. But open injury mandates that we're doing something different with this, and she's got a large soft tissue injury. Oops. So she has an open bimal ankle fracture. We've seen that these are increasing as our population gets older and older. They can be one side of it, unimalleolar, bimal, trimal, open 2% of the time. Basically, our distal fibula, distal tibia, create a bony mortise down here to stabilize the ankle. If this breaks and it shifts over, every 1 millimeter of lateral talar shift decreases tibio-talar contact 42%. It's been drilled into me ever since orthopedic residency every day. Increase your incidence of arthritis, and so that's why it's important to fix it in the appropriate position. Physical exam is kind of obvious. It's going to be painful where it's broken. And on our x-rays, what we're looking at is we want to make sure that this joint line is intact. We want to also see if you have a breakthrough this bone, this bone's going to move up, and then you're going to lose your dime sign. And that's basically where the distal fibula here creates a nice little dime. So Shenton's line, look for any incongruity, and your dime sign. We're not going to go in detail on the classifications. Basically, just know that there are Log-Hansen, Weber. Log-Hansen, based on cadaveric study, position of the foot, and the relative force applied to the tibia at the time of injury. Supination external rotation injuries make up the majority of your ankle fractures, though you do have supination adduction, PER, and pronation abduction. Weber classification is the easiest one for most people to use, and the idea is that it's easy to say from nurse, resident, attending that doesn't know, you know, how to read an x-ray, you can easily do this, and that's why it's one of the better ones. And the idea is that the higher the fibula injury, the more severe the condition. So Weber A is right here. It's below the ankle joint. So this is a Weber A. Weber B is at the level. So we can see here's the ankle joint, and it pops up right here. So this is a Weber B. Weber C, we can see it's above the ankle joint up here. So Weber A, not that bad. Weber B, it's a moderate. Weber C, absolutely painful. Okay? So treatments based on stability of the ankle. Think of the ankle as a ring. We have all the structures stabilizing it. If you take a ring and you break one of these things, the rest of the ring is going to be stable enough to hold it intact. Okay? And so a single part is usually stable. However, if you make two breaks in the ring, then it's an unstable injury, and this can shift all around and move everywhere, and that's when we tend to fix. So our non-operative treatment, non-displaced stable fractures, CAM boot for about 6 weeks, functional rehab. Surgical indications, if there's a joint incongruity, articular step-off, any sort of instability, as we talked about before. So this is an example, basically going down to the area of the fracture, lag screw, plate, protect your neurovascular structures. This is one of my cases from a couple years ago. We can see that there's deltoid ligament instability here, and we can see that here's the fibula fracture on the lateral. It's way up here, and there's a posterior mal fragment here with some interposition. Chose to do this posterior lateral approach, put on a nice big plate, fix the posterior mal here, and we can see that the ankle mortise is restored. So specifically for our patient, when we brought her to the OR, her skin is horrible. She's 93 years old. Just touching her skin basically would shear it off. So trying to make an incision on here and put a plate on there is probably not the best idea. So because she was open and her skin was so bad, we put on an external fixator to hold her in position. And we can see that the ankle joint's better reduced. This is all in the appropriate position. And the X-Fix frame is in place. So our traditional ORIF, as I said, is not really good. So what are our options to treat her? You could treat her in an X-Fix, just say, hey, you get this frame on for the rest of the time until it heals, then we take it off. That's a perfectly good option. We remove the X-Fix and place a splint. However, the problem with that is that she's got the soft tissue area that we really want to observe. She got that open wound. So we need to do dressing changes on it daily. If she's in a splint, you're taking her out of the splint. She's unstable because the ankle fracture is flopping around. She's not going to like you. You attempt the ORIF. That's pretty gutsy because her skin sucks and you're likely to have a problem. Or you consider more of a minimally invasive type approach. So that's what I did with her. Decided to use an intramedullary nail in the distal fibula, and basically through the appropriate methods of guiding the wire in and guiding the fibula in, got the fibular rod into the fibula, reduced it, and stabilized it. And this was her outcome. I think she was about 5 weeks out here. We can see that small little incisions along the side of the ankle to get the appropriate guides and hardware in. And this on the medial aspect of her ankle. This allowed for daily dressing changes, allowed for very good wound care. And that's it. So, thank you. Any questions or anything? Yeah. All right, so you know, it depends on the severity of the wound, but basically I'll do 3 days. I like Rocephin. That's just what I was trained with. But you know, depending on the contamination, we do 3 days of antibiotics, and then if you return to the OR for a repeat washout, then I'll do another 3 days after that as well. All right, have a great day. Thanks.